Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and thank you for joining us once again on the Saturday Frights podcast. Halloween is almost here, and next week we're going to have quite a few friends of the podcast on to discuss Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. So we felt it would be a good choice to talk about a segment from Rod Serling's Night Gallery this week, one that happens to be directed by Steven Spielberg, entitled Make Me Laugh.
Not that I found much to laugh at with this particular episodic television offering, Sage.
I don't think you're supposed to, projectionist. That's kind of the point, right? This is most certainly a be careful what you wish for story, like Serling presented on The Twilight Zone with Time Enough at Last or Man in the Bottle. Make Me Laugh aired on NBC back on January 6th, 1971. It was the first of two segments for this Night Gallery episode, the second being Clean Kills and Other Trophies, that dealt with a big game hunter that is abusive to his son and how dark forces give him his comeuppance. Since this is a TV episode, please be advised that we will give a brief but full discussion on the story, so if you haven't seen it for yourself, you might want to pause the podcast and hop on over to Hulu and watch it before listening further. Now, as I've already mentioned, Make Me Laugh was directed by Steven Spielberg, and it stars the late great Godfrey Cambridge as Jackie Slater, a comedian who has hit rock bottom. As usual on the Night Gallery, especially the first season, Rod Serling delivers a wonderful intro.
On display this evening, a pastiche of painting from Oddball Land. The poet Sir Max Beerbohm reflected that no one ever died of laughter. Object of brush and palette, the rebuttal. The clown is Jackie Slater, his occupation, a comedian. His aspirations, to collect funny bones and hang them on the walls of his life to hide the cracked plaster and yellowed wallpaper that is part of the interior decoration of failure. Poor Jackie Slater. A bad joke told in a foreign language in an empty hall. The comic unable to coax laughter. The painting is called Make Me Laugh, and this lightless limbo is called the Night Gallery.
As the show begins proper and we are introduced to Jackie, he's playing a sleazy nightclub, acting as an MC in between the acts featuring scantily clad dancing girls. Jackie is absolutely dying up on stage. His jokes are, to be fair, quite lousy. But worst of all, he knows he's failing. We can see, thanks to Godfrey's wonderful acting, he is flailing about in an attempt to connect with his audience, a collection of people who seem far more interested in their drinks and food than Jackie's attempts at humor. The desperation is all too easy to read in his eyes, and he is sweating buckets under the lights. Sensing he isn't going to win over the audience, he introduces the girls, to which the crowd seem quite happy to see take the stage. As he opens the door to his dressing room, we are introduced to his friend and manager of 16 years, Jules Kettleman, played by Happy Days' Tom Bosley. Jackie is a portrait of despair and woe. Kettleman does his best to try and raise his friend's spirits, but both men know that things are looking bad for the duo. It's not helped when the owner of the club, Mr. Mishkin, played by the Munsters' Al Lewis, arrives to fire Jackie. In despair, the comedian makes his way to a nearby bar in an attempt to drown his sorrows, but the universe isn't quite through kicking him in the teeth just yet. He's informed by the bartender that Kettleman called to let his friend know he's accepted the management gig for a band. Overhearing this tale of woe is another gentleman, who takes this opportunity to introduce himself.
We have not met you, Fendi. Chatterjee is the name. Miracles by profession.
Miracles.
Miracles.
That's just what I need, Mr. Chatterjee. You are now face to face with Mr. Unlucky.
This miracle man, played by Jackie Vernon, is dressed as a modern-day swami.
Forgive the interruption, Victor. The character of Chatterjee is quite frankly a gross caricature. One step removed from an actor in blackface.
Yeah, considering when this episode came out, it's a little tough to get over. One can't help but play armchair quarterback in regards to the casting department for this role. Perhaps this was a case of the producers wanting the legendary comedian Vernon in the role. Makes sense considering the subject of the episode. But Serling had, of course, written the role for an Indian actor. Focusing on another role of Vernon, did his voice sound familiar to you, listeners?
Happy birthday! Hey, I said my first words. But snowmen can't talk.
Yeah, even though Vernon was better known for his rather adult stand-up humor, he was in fact a prolific voice actor, which is how he landed the role of Frosty in 1969's Rankin and Bass animated holiday classic Frosty the Snowman. Back on subject, Chatterjee explains to Jackie Slater that he is in something of a pickle. He has until midnight to grant a miracle to a deserving soul, or he will have his abilities as a miracle man stripped of him. It might be the booze that Jackie has been drinking, but he is desperate enough to beg Chatterjee to grant him the ability to make people laugh, which Chatterjee admits he can easily accomplish, but there is kind of a caveat attached. And frankly, it's that the miracle man isn't that good. His miracles come true, but have a tendency to backfire on those that asked for them. Jackie, like I said, is so tired of being a failure, he refuses to heed the warning, and so Chatterjee grants him his miracle. It immediately takes effect, as all that Jackie does is ask a question, and it sends the bartender and the rest of the patrons into hysterics. Jackie thanks the miracle man profusely, but why does Chatterjee look so very, very glum? We next see that Jackie is headlining in Vegas to sold-out crowds. We hear the audience's thunderous applause from his dressing room because he has a visitor, his old friend and manager, Kettleman, who sheepishly greets the now wildly popular comedian. For what it's worth, it seems that while Jackie gives his friend a bit of a hard time for leaving him, which is understandable, the way that Cambridge handles it, you can tell he's glad to have his friend back. Prepare yourself for a bit of a shocker, friends. Jackie is very unhappy. While he is indeed more popular than he could have ever imagined, appearing on talk shows, selling out theaters, he's bored, because that miracle that was given to him allows him to make people laugh without him even remotely trying. As his friend mentions, he has to but open his mouth to get the audience to giggle in hysterics. Since it doesn't appear to work on Kettleman, I can only assume that the power kicks in when he's performing. Jackie is getting all manner of offers from Hollywood, but the one that catches his eye is from a playwright who is interested in him playing a dramatic role as a burnt-out comedian. Kettleman is confused as to why Jackie would want to become a serious actor when he has finally obtained his dream. But Slater has made up his mind. He will now become a dramatic star. As you can probably already guess, that doesn't work out well at all, as when he's rehearsing, even though the dialogue is moving, the director and those assembled begin to bust out laughing. Believe it or not, it's a heartbreaking scene, as a once again defeated Jackie is reminded of how people laughed at him as a little boy at camp. Outside of the theater, Jackie angrily confronts Chatterjee, who's been kind of following him, probably to see just how bad his miracle went off course. Slater physically threatens the miracle worker into giving him another miracle. This time, he wants to have the ability to make people cry. Chatterjee argues that a second miracle is against the code, but once again Jackie refuses to listen, and he receives his wish for the second time. To test out this new ability, Jackie calls across the street to an elderly woman selling flowers. She doesn't seem to hear him, and the former comedian steps out into the street, where he is struck and killed by an oncoming car. As a crowd gathers to look on the broken body of Jackie Slater, the elderly woman, that looks suspiciously like the Night Gallery painting for this segment, begins to weep loudly. That, friends, is the full, and I certainly hope, brief synopsis for Make Me Laugh. Projectionist, besides the obvious odd choice of trying to pass Vernon off as an Indian, do you have any thoughts on the story itself?
You already pointed it out, but it felt to me as if perhaps a scene had been left out. There wasn't a clear explanation as to how the miracle worked. Jackie Slater mentions he can't even order a glass of orange juice without causing someone to go into hysterics.
Yeah, I just feel that when he's putting on his persona of the Jackie Slater, it kicks in. You're right, though. It would have been nice if that had been explained a little better.
There is, of course, the fact that he is slain. That seems rather harsh.
Well, this is the Night Gallery. a little darker and meaner than what we normally saw on the Twilight Zone. But, and I guess I should have brought this up, Jackie, while you will certainly feel sorry for him at many points in the segment, also displays a frightening other side of his personality, a very selfish side.
Agreed. But this personality, fault, is it a crime? Is it worth being struck and killed by an automobile?
Remember, Projectionist, that he was also threatening to assault Shatterjay if he didn't get a second miracle. Even though the miracle worker warned him of the dangers of getting his wish granted, Jackie wasn't satisfied and wanted to have his cake and eat it too.
Then let me ask you this, Sage. Did you feel that Shatterjay was responsible for Jackie Slater's death? What I mean is, do you believe he magically summoned the speeding vehicle to kill the comedian?
No, I don't. I think maybe he sensed what was coming after he granted the wish, but no, I do not believe that Shatterjay murdered Jackie. It's that Twilight Zone / Night Gallery cosmic justice. More often than not, an evil person will get their comeuppance, especially in the Twilight Zone series. But, every so often, the fairness is tipped wildly off kilter, and you have the outcome of this episode. Or, of course, Time Enough at Last, for example. Switching gears, Projectionist, did you enjoy the acting in this segment?
Yes. It was nice to see Tom Bosley playing to form as a schlep.
He sort of played a similar character in another Steven Spielberg-directed segment for the Night Gallery TV movie entitled Eyes. We will have to take a crack at that one at some point on the podcast. It's odd to see Bosley, for me, portray a character like this when I remember him best as Howard Cunningham in Happy Days. I think, though, that the whole show is carried on the shoulders of Godfrey Cambridge. I felt he was more than capable as the leading character. To be fair, Make Me Laugh isn't the greatest Night Gallery segment, but it's still a strong entry and an enjoyable one, especially worthy of viewing as Halloween approaches. It's a very straightforward story. I would even say it's almost simple.
Agreed. How did you feel about Steven Spielberg's filming approach on this television episode?
What do you mean?
What I'm getting at, Victor, is would you not agree that it isn't as flashy as the camera work, the angles he used in Eyes?
Well, sure. Maybe a scene with a nightclub band stands out a little. I see what you're getting at, but yet again, it's a different type of story from Eyes. I guess it doesn't exactly feel like a Steven Spielberg production. Of course, he was very young and probably still finding his way at this point. When did the TV movie Duel air?
November of 1971, Sage.
Wow. Maybe then this was a case of Spielberg not being allowed to be very flashy. I've heard that the producer of Night Gallery, Jack Laird, could be very temperamental on the directors of segments if they didn't come in on time and on budget. Well, I'm not sure if I have anything else to add about this segment, Projectionist. Do you have any vintage ads for our listeners this week?
Just one.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week, and you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous, but you let people go swimming anyway.
Did you see that? devices.
Huh? What?
You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Is it true that most people get attacked by sharks in 3 feet of water, about 10 feet from the beach?
Yeah.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
Bad fish. But I'll catch him and kill him.
Did you hear your father? Out of the water now!
This shark, swallow you whole.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's a 20-footer.
25. 3 tons of them.
He's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now.
Don't wait for me. Now! Shoot!
Man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws. Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Jaws. See it before you go swimming.
Holy cow! The original Jaws trailer was almost 4 minutes long? Well, I don't believe I really need to talk about Steven Spielberg's notable films and TV work, as we have in fact discussed them before, on the Night Gallery Cemetery episode, and of course, on the Poltergeist episode. Of course, we've talked quite a bit about the career of Rod Serling as well, and I'm sure we will again next week with our friends. Godfrey Cambridge sadly passed away November 29, 1976, at the far too young age of 43. He had 35 acting credits, with notable roles in such film and TV projects as 1961's Splendor in the Grass, 1966 I Spy, 1967's The President's Analyst, where he co-starred with James Coburn, 1970's blaxploitation film Cotton Comes to Harlem, and of course, 1972's Beware the Blob, the Larry Hagman-directed sequel to the 1958 classic, that the Retroist covered on his own podcast just a few weeks back. Tom Bosley passed away on October 19th, 2010, and had 152 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in 1969's The Debbie Reynolds Show, where he appeared in 18 episodes as Bob Landers. He was the voice of Harry Boyles in 48 episodes of the primetime animated series Wait Till Your Father Gets Home. He was also seen in the 1976 Walt Disney comedy, Gus, and of course appeared in 255 episodes of the hit TV series Happy Days, which ran from 1974 until 1984. In his later years, he was probably best known for playing Father Dowling in the popular Father Dowling Mysteries. Jackie Vernon passed away in 1987 with 15 acting credits, but those included appearances in 1975's Kolchak the Night Stalker in the episode entitled Demon in Lace, the oddball mafia comedy The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, 1983's Microwave Massacre, and 1987's Amazon Women on the Moon. Al Lewis passed away on February 3, 2006, and had earned 54 acting credits, with notable roles in 1959's The Phil Silvers Show, 1960's Pretty Boy Floyd, 44 episodes of 1961's Car 54, Where Are You?, and of course, 72 episodes of The Munsters, where he would co-star with fellow Car 54 actor Fred Gwynn. He was also in the criminally overlooked 1980 comedy Used Cars as Judge Harrison, and was even host for TBS's Super Scary Saturday TV program that would show a particular monster movie in the early afternoon. One of his last roles was a cameo in the 1995 TV movie Here Comes the Munsters. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
They need merely seek out a rare miracle man. But I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist, Haunted Drive-In.
We do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe, maybe even leave us a nice review if you are pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.